This week, Israeli tanks conducted a targeted raid into Gaza to test their plans and to prepare the ground for the full-scale invasion.
In the modern period, urban warfare, particularly for states who care about civilian casualties, it negates some of the technological advantages that in a more open environment would make it a very lopsided conflict. In general, it often favors the defense, as long as the defender is local to the city. Another thing to consider, you know, we've mostly been framing this discussion from the idea that there is some value to the people in the city you're taking. When you add that to a conflict that has ethnic cleansing, that is not the case. Another thing to consider that you have to deal with urban warfare is underground warfare. I think it's that there's no good way to do it.
Oh, wow.
Urban warfare is absolutely horrific. It is incredibly taxing on the individual fighters. There's interesting research coming out of, you know, the American kind of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that seems to be indicating that because you're having to make the decisions about is this person a combatant or not, you know, particularly if you're dealing with a type of urban warfare where your opponent isn't in uniform necessarily, that it has a much more kind of taxing on mental health. It is always going to be bad for civilians. Ending a war, getting out, having a better peace is often the hardest part.
Did you know that after the French Revolution of 1789, Paris witnessed 7 major armed uprisings and revolts between 1830 and 1848, during which rebels and residents constructed barricades in the narrow streets of Paris, which bolstered their defenses against the French army. To prevent this sort of urban warfare from happening again, under the direction of Emperor Napoleon III, starting in 1853, the French government demolished the medieval neighborhoods of Paris and widened and straightened their narrow and winding streets so that the people cannot build barricades. And Mark Twain back then explained why the French army would want to straighten the streets of Paris so that, quote, a cannonball could traverse from end to end without meeting an obstruction more irresistible than the flesh and bones of men, end quote. So, next time when you're in Paris and you gaze down the long avenue, just remember, you get to enjoy that unobstructed view because of urban warfare. Hey there, news peelers. Today is October 27, 2023. And this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it. According to the New York Times, Israel's bombing of more than 7,000 targets inside Gaza exceeds the United States' most intense bombing campaign against ISIS in Mosul, Iraq, a history that we'll talk about in this episode. And based on the increasing number of casualties in Gaza, this is the deadliest conflict for Palestinians since at least the Lebanon War of 1982. Israeli officials claim that their targets inside Gaza include rocket launchers, command centers, and munitions factories. And very importantly, as my guest, Dr. Mary Elizabeth Walters, will tell us about the history of urban warfare, tunnels. Israelis are targeting hundreds of miles of tunnels under Gaza. An Israeli military spokesman explained that the air war is to prepare the ground for an invasion. And a retired Israeli Air Force general explained that part of this preparation is to take out high points that could be used by Hamas snipers, and it's also to flatten structures so that they cannot be used for guerrilla warfare. So, what about the civilians in Gaza? Schools, hospitals, mosques, churches, their water supplies, their electricity, and their other means of living. In the last section of our conversation, Dr. Walters and I talk about this from the perspective of lessons we've learned from history. But for now, I'll tell you this much. As reported by a recent Wall Street Journal article, Palestinians are refusing to leave North Gaza, despite Israeli bombing. The headline of this Wall Street Journal article quotes a Palestinian, "If I die, I die." The subheading of this article is also telling, quote, "Many families won't leave their homes in the north, fearing a repeat of the mass displacement 75 years ago," end quote. I've dropped links to the articles I've mentioned here in the detailed caption of this episode. So, when did the concept of urban warfare, urban fighting, first appear in history? And how has it evolved since? What are the rules of engagement here? And what are the restraints? And what tactics and strategies are taught in military schools about urban warfare? To get answers to these questions, I spoke with Dr. Walters, an assistant professor of military and security studies in the Department of International Security at the Air Command and Staff College. She received both her master's and doctorate degrees in military history from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Walters is currently working on an oral history project exploring Operation Allies Welcome, the U.S. military support for the evacuation and resettlement of Afghans spanning 2021 to 2022. Her second book project, Hospitality in the Law of the Mountains, the 1999 Kosovo War, examines how Albanians, motivated by the Albanian concept of hospitality, took strangers into their homes and communities and changed the course of the refugee crisis. During the course of our conversation, Dr. Walters takes us from urban warfare in Roman Britain to uprisings in Paris and from there to World War II's battle over Stalingrad, a city with no strategic value, just the psychological importance of its name, and then to the Tet Offensive in Vietnam and ethnic cleansing in the 1990s Yugoslav Wars. To learn more about Dr. Walters, you can click the link in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Walters and I peel the history behind this news.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Walters, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me. Is urban warfare a term that's always been around in human history, or is there like a specific time or event or period that you can point to and say, aha, this is where the term urban warfare entered our lexicon?
Yeah. Hi, Adele. First, thank you for having me on. And I want to give a quick disclaimer that my views are my own and are not those of the Air Command and Staff College or the U.S. Air Force.
For sure.
Get that out of the way. Yes. So the practice of urban warfare is not new, right? There have been cities for thousands of years that have been involved in fighting. You know, if you think back to Roman Britain and Boudica, when she led the revolt of the Iceni, one of the first things she did was attack the Roman town of Camulodunum, which is modern Colchester, and burned it and kind of looted it.
Isn't there a statue of her in London?
There is, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right. Okay.
Yeah. In the early modern period, sieges of cities were really common. And there were kind of norms about how you went about doing this, where the attacking army would kind of send a messenger demanding the surrender. It was kind of expected that the garrison would resist. But there was a window of acceptable resistance. So if you resisted and did a token resistance for a few days, then usually like you'd be fined, but everyone inside would be mostly okay. But if you really like held out because you thought like a reinforcing army was going to come and relieve you, at that point, then everyone knew that if the attacking army broke through your defenses, that they could really do whatever they want with the city.
Oh, wow.
So the practice of having to fight in urban environments is pretty old. The term is a lot more recent.
Mm-hmm. How recent?
This was kind of fun to dig into, but at least based on the Google Ngram search function, where you can use their digitized books, Google Books, to look for the frequencies of different words.
Oh, yeah.
It first kind of enters the lexicon around the 1850s, coinciding with the Crimean War. So if you think about like battles around like Sevastopol, areas that are now back in the news. But it doesn't really pick on. There's some slight upticks in the 1910s. So this is during, before the First World War, but during, say, the Balkan Wars, where you have some fighting in urban areas. A little bit more in World War One, but there's really not that much in the way of urban fighting in the First World War, at least on the Western Front. You get some more on the Eastern Front or in the Mediterranean. And then you start to get more usage in World War II, but really there is a dramatic spike in the usage in the 1960s.
Why the 1960s?
Yeah. So you have a growing number of communist-linked guerrilla movements happening around the world. In Latin America and Africa, you have the anti-colonial movement. And so you start to see a lot more fighting happening in cities in this period. And then by the time you get to the Vietnam War, it is firmly embedded in the lexicon, and you start seeing military publications and discussions around it.
I see. And interestingly, this urban warfare that was occurring in the 1960s and going, I guess, to through the 1970s, the Vietnam War, is not happening in Europe or even Eastern Europe. It's probably happening, and I'm just conjecturing here based on what I've read about history, probably South America and the Far East, right?
Mm-hmm. So you do get some. So you have uprisings that happen in Budapest and Prague.
That's right. Yeah.
So you have, but those are different in that the people who are uprising aren't well armed. So it's you have the tanks in the cities, but it's not what we think of with like urban warfare, where you have a well-armed insurgency or guerrilla force.
Or even well-organized in way of sort of military ways and military training. And by the way, I just want to clarify for our audience, this is an interesting time period you were talking about. You said the 1850s, the Crimean War, that's a war where France, the French Empire, then the British Empire, fought the Russian Empire, and it was over Crimea, what's happening. Yeah. Now, going back to 2014, we talked about guerrilla warfare and going back to the 1960s in balance of power. And I'm wondering, does urban warfare give one side a boost, sort of kind of like an advantage that they would not otherwise have had?
Mm. So it depends. In general, it often favors the defense, as long as the defender is local to the city. And in part, that's because they're going to know the city, they're going to know the alleys and the back streets, and not be reliant on maps as much, which may or may not be accurate, may or may not be super detailed in terms of all of these backways. They're also more likely to have local civilian support than the attacking force. So it does tend to favor the defender. In the modern period, urban warfare, particularly for states who care about civilian casualties, it negates some of the technological advantages that in a more open environment would make it a very lopsided conflict.
So what I'm saying is that a very advanced army that could do all sorts of things, army, navy, air force, whatever, in open terrain would be somewhat constrained in urban warfare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
To some degree, it affects both sides, right? So in an urban environment, you can't mass your forces. So almost everything...
I'm sorry, I didn't get that word. You cannot
mass your forces? So you can't gather in large numbers.
Okay.
So instead of, moving your troops forward in kind of these large organized units, you're looking at really small groups. Sometimes just five or six, fighters. It tends to be very decentralized. So depending on the time period you're looking at, communication is a real problem, like being able to organize all of these forces and have them convergent at the same time, the same place, can be really difficult. It in some ways it's an equalizer, but it can give the weaker side some advantages.
So with all the challenges that you're sharing with me for the invading force, army, military, are there special urban warfare military tactics?
Yes. So because a lot of what kind of standard warfare in an open area you would do, you can't do in a city. Mm-hmm. And some of it'll depend on the layout of the city. So if you think of old European cities with really narrow streets, it's going to be different than if you're fighting in Paris, where in response to a series of uprisings that happened in the 19th century, they actually decided to widen the streets so that you couldn't barricade them. But it makes it much easier to move tanks down. It takes enormous training to be able to operate in an urban environment. So what we call combined arms operations. So when you have different types of units working together, mm-hmm. So you might think of tanks working with infantry and artillery. So on their own, each piece is vulnerable to the other. So tanks are vulnerable to attacks from infantry. Infantry are vulnerable to attacks from tanks, and artillery are vulnerable to both without being supported. And doing this in open terrain is very difficult. Doing it in the confines of a city on a street and an alley takes enormous discipline to do.
I see. This makes me think of the European cities that I've visited. I haven't visited too many cities in the Middle East, so I don't know what Gaza, Beirut, Jerusalem, or any of these would be like. But imagine conducting urban warfare in the meandering streets of, let's say, Siena or Venice, right?
Right.
Or like Bath, England. You couldn't have, a tank supporting infantry. It wouldn't even fit into the streets. So,
you know, and something else to kind of think about with this is, you know, for the attacker, it's a strategic choice to decide to go into the city, right? Because you don't have to. You, depending on what you're doing, you can bypass the city, you can surround it and put it under siege. So you're making the choice to go in. Another thing to consider that you have to deal with urban warfare is underground warfare.
Underground warfare.
Cities, any large city is going to have like a metro.
Yeah.
So you have the underground metro tunnels. You have underground utilities, sewer systems that can be used to move between areas. I'm not going to smell the greatest, but in terms of moving and not being seen. And that's not to mention places like, you know, Gaza today, where Hamas has had lots of time to build tunnels for the explicit purpose of being able to use them in war. And so having to deal with that is another component. Intelligence in war is always important, but it becomes particularly important in urban warfare. It can be in the urban jungle, it can be really hard to tell where forces are because if they're inside a building, you can't see them.
Yeah.
So that can be very difficult. You also have to be aware of where the civilians are. So again, like intelligence takes on an added importance in urban warfare.
I was reading something interesting, Dr. Walters, in the New York Times and also similar articles in the Wall Street Journal. They were saying how there's sniper attacks that occur in urban warfare. But something that I hadn't thought about is that sound gets distorted so that directionally it may not be immediately clear where that shot came from, where in open terrain you could say, okay, it came from that direction or whatever. So having talked about all of this, does the U.S. have specially trained urban warfare sort of military units?
So the U.S. has an urban warfare training center.
We do? Okay. Mm-hmm. Where is that?
The U.S. Army has one. So units will, as part of their training schedule, will rotate through, and it's, you know, a chance for them to practice some of this. What does it mean to have to, you know, clear rooms, go building by building, and think about these things? So yes, we have at the training center. There are, you know, depending on the training cycle, you know, there may be more or less focus on urban warfare among all the other kind of things that units have to keep up with. And then you have special forces who will have kind of higher levels of training depending on their focus area on how to do urban warfare.
So in addition to the regular, let's say, army soldier, they may have special units particularly trained at higher level for urban warfare. I got that. You know, we're talking about urban warfare entering, invading a certain area, or perhaps putting it to siege. Dr. Walters, I thought of a prior military historian in our program who highlighted something that I want to share with you, and I'll just paraphrase it here for you and our audience. He said that while war is hard, ending wars is harder still. So let's apply that statement to urban warfare. So do military tactics manuals, do they teach how to get out? How, like, what's the exit strategy? We conquered. What now? And this actually played out in Iraq.
Yeah. It is, I would agree, like ending a war, getting out, having a better peace is often the hardest part. U.S. doctrine does lay out guidelines that as you are planning the initial urban warfare operation, that you need to be thinking about what happens next. So, for example, in looking at what to do about infrastructure in cities.
Yeah.
That you need to be thinking about, okay, is the infrastructure only going to affect the city? So if a power grid were taken out in order to reduce your opponent's ability to resist, how long would it take you to put it back? Is it only going to knock out the power in the city, or are there outlying areas that rely on that same power grid? So how big of a swath of area are you going to be affecting? How much is it going to cost to rebuild it? What type of like cost are you going to bear in terms of like local population's attitude? So are you going to sour relations so badly that it's going to make anything that comes afterwards difficult? That being said, that's a lot easier to put in doctrine than to come up with answers when you actually try to put it in practice.
Yeah, I was just thinking about your example of power grid. How do you really, if it's the same power grid that's just dispersed radially to different directions, it may be very hard to take out just part of it.
Mm-hmm. So like in Kosovo, as part of Allied force, the U.S. experimented with a special type of bomb that was supposed to spread like magnets.
Magnets?
Yeah, that was supposed to like damage the ability of some of the equipment to work. I don't do science, so I don't understand like that part of it. But the idea behind it was to try and find a way that you would leave like the infrastructure itself intact, just make it unusable for a short period. It wasn't hugely successful, but, you know, so there are attempts to try and figure out how do you deny the use to the opponent so that you're protecting your own forces, but do it in a way where you're not causing undue hardship on the civilian population.
You know, this discussion of the civilian population, has a lot of psychological components that are probably way beyond the scope of our conversation. But, you know, you go in, you take out the enemy, you don't want to leave the area so devastated that now you just gave rise to a whole new generation of enemies in whatever, not just this Gaza conflict, but throughout history. That's very interesting. We'll be back after a short break to talk about stories of urban warfare. Earlier this year, when Russia's invasion of Ukraine turned into its second year, I questioned whether or not that war was essentially becoming a war of attrition. And if so, what's the history of attrition warfare? And which party may benefit from it, the weaker defending party or the stronger invading party? Dr. Sebastian Lukasik was my guest for that episode. He's a professor in the Department of Leadership and Research Development and Air Command at Air Command and Staff College. I've provided a link to my conversation with him in Season 3, Episode 8. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Walters about the history of urban warfare. Dr. Walters, what are some examples of urban warfare?
So I want to start this with Stalingrad and World War II.
Okay.
In part because in a lot of ways it is the like example that everyone goes to. But I think it highlights a couple things. So the first part of our discussion, we talked a lot about like being careful, wanting to not target civilians. And in part, we can do that because of advances in technology. You couldn't do that even if you wanted to as much in World War II because limitations with bombing and accuracy and precision, right? So the Battle of Stalingrad, it lasts from roughly August 1942 to February 1943. It is part of a bigger operation that the Germans are driving, trying to drive into the Caucasus to get access to the oil fields there. Stalingrad is not supposed to be an objective. It's simply supposed to be
It became a major point in World War II. Oh, so interesting.
It's where they chose to cut off at the Volga, which is a major river. It's not key to anything in terms of like military strategy, but it does have the name Stalingrad, so Stalin's city. And so it takes on this psychological importance for both Hitler and for the Soviet. And it becomes absolutely brutal. This kind of slog fest between Field Marshal Friedrich Paulus and the German 6th Army, which starts out with about 80,000 men. And then you have Lieutenant General Vasily Chukov and the 62nd Army, which has about 55,000 troops. But they keep getting reinforcements across the Volga. And so it actually is regenerated at least 3 times over the course of this engagement. In terms of losses, like Soviets lose, like in the initial Stalingrad itself, at least 320,000 dead. With about that same number wounded or sick, comes out to an average of over 5,000 casualties a day.
My gosh. So we're
talking absolutely brutal fighting.
And when you say 320,000 dead and wounded, does that include civilians or is that just Soviet soldiers?
That's harder to tell. So at the time, the Soviets weren't open with the numbers. it's very difficult to tell. Estimates in terms of Soviet civilian casualties from World War II in general range from, I think, 8 to 15 million.
Soviet casualties. Okay, yeah.
Soviet civilian casualties.
Civilian
casualties. Not just at Stalingrad, but for the war in general. So that kind of gives you a sense of the scale.
Yeah.
Given the length of this engagement, by the end, there are not really civilians in Stalingrad.
I was going to ask that. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers on either side. Who can even live there?
Yeah, I mean, by the midpoint, they are dead or they have managed to escape the city. This type of fighting there is a factory that kept changing hands, going room by room, and the Germans and the Soviets fought over this one factory complex for about 4 weeks.
Wow.
I mean, so if you think about that, like the most recent parallel would be in Mariupol, in the fighting in Ukraine, where you had Ukrainians holding out in the old steel refinery factory complex.
That's right. We saw aerial views of that on TV, CNN, whatever you watch. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so it's the same idea that these types of industrial areas can be absolutely brutal, room by room, corridor by corridor. The same with apartment complexes, where, you know, you might have Germans and Soviet forces in different apartments. And so it's absolutely like gut-wrenching fighting. As it went on, the Soviet strategy shifted. They realized that the Germans were not fighting a sustainable fight because their logistics just couldn't keep up with this. And so they used Chukov to hold the Germans in place while they prepare a counteroffensive. And so Chukov is getting just enough reinforcements in terms of people and ammunition to hang on, not to succeed, not to be safe, but just enough so that he's still providing a resistance so that the German Sixth Army is stuck. And then Zhukov, with a Z, they sound very similar. It can be confusing. Zhukov comes and does an envelopment. And then it is the German Sixth Army that is surrounded and trapped in Stalingrad. And eventually,
so the conquering army itself now is under siege.
Yes. Another thing that I think Stalingrad shows is the mixed benefit of air power. So in the opening acts, the Luftwaffe bombs Stalingrad and kills large numbers of Soviets in the city, about 30,000 in late August. So right as the fighting in Stalingrad is beginning. But the trick is, air power is very good at blowing things up. For urban warfare, rubble is as useful as an intact building. So once you've blown up these buildings, either with artillery or air power, then now you have obstacles in the streets. Right? So the streets are no longer clear. You have to deal with the rubble. You have issues with like your own shelter, right? You've damaged key buildings. Now you're trying to move through. And it's an easy place for the defending force to lay traps and kind of use for cover. So you get a mixed bag with air power with that.
So in effect, by bombing Stalingrad, the German Air Force creates issues for itself when it enters the city, when it conquers the city.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's kind of Stalingrad.
Okay.
If you think about the Vietnam War, there's some standout cases of urban warfare there as well. So in 1968, you get the Tet Offensive. So starts in January of 68, the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong, rise up. And the idea is to strike at a large number of state, like provincial capitals, major cities. On the same day, they're hitting over 100 major urban targets. And that really stretches the South Vietnamese forces and the American forces very thin.
Wait, you said on the same day they're hitting 100 targets. That's within the South Vietnam territory. Yes. That's one heck of a coordination there.
Yes. I mean, it was incredibly organized. It was a major risk. Militarily, it doesn't work. In terms of American public opinion, it does.
Also.
So up to that point, the messaging coming out of South Vietnam from the military, from kind of political officials, is that the war is going well. We're winning.
I see.
And then you have the shock of Tet, and the North Vietnamese forces and the Viet Cong are crushed. Like, the Viet Cong just about is wiped out. After the Tet Offensive, almost all of the fighting is being done by North Vietnamese forces instead of South Vietnamese forces who are loyal to the North.
Yeah.
So militarily, it's a failure, but psychologically, it's a massive success. One of the areas where you see some of the worst fighting is in Hue. So Hue is the old imperial capital of the kind of historic empire of Vietnam. You have like the Imperial Palace. You have many historical landmarks. It is also at the time the provincial capital of Thua Thinh in the First Corps tactical zone, and it's the second closest province to the DMZ, so the demilitarized zone between North Vietnam and South Vietnam. It has about 140,000 residents. at the time, but had a lot more people there and had some refugees, so folks who had fled fighting in other areas in Vietnam and had sought shelter in Hue. And then you had other people who were in the city for the Tet holiday. So you, although the residence is 140, you had more people than that in the city.
That had come in, okay, for the Tet holiday, okay.
Mm-hmm. So with this, the initial attack is incredibly successful. The North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong forces succeed in taking the majority of the city within about a day or two. And then it is a very long slog trying to retake the city with the Marines, the 1st Marines, along with elements of the 5th and the 11th Marines, working with South Vietnamese forces to try and retake that. U.S. and South Vietnamese military casualties involve 524 dead and almost 2,000 wounded. On the communist side, the numbers are harder to get, but it looks like probably close to 5,000 casualties in Hue and another 3,000 in the surrounding area. The fighting, again, like Stalingrad, is house to house. Wow. It took 3 weeks to clear a 7-block area.
3 weeks to clear a 7-block area. Yep. That must have been bloody.
It was, I keep saying this, but it was absolutely brutal fighting. It's considered some of the hardest fighting of the Vietnam War, at least on the American side of things.
Dr. Walters, if I may stop you for one moment, please. You know, in the last example, you were talking about that factory in Stalingrad and you analogize it to Mariupol, and now we're talking about this 7-block area. At some point, this is almost hand-to-hand combat. At some point, like your technological advance, I don't know, weaponry may not have that much use when your enemy is just around the wall and now they take out their knife. I know I'm simplifying it, but am I close?
No, you're right on. I mean, and keep in mind also, you know, so by the Vietnam War, close air support has come a long way from World War II, right? So like World War II, close air support is not going to be able to help you very much in an urban environment because it's just not accurate enough. The communication isn't good enough. You're more likely to hit a friendly target than an opponent one. CAS has come a long way by the time you get to Vietnam, but once you get to this close quarters fighting where you are, you know, room to room, you are fighting to move, air support isn't going to help you. It can help provide interdiction, so to cut off your opponent's supply lines. It can do that, but in terms of, you know, actually helping you clear a building, move to the next block, it's going to be minimal support. Your artillery also like might be useful as long as you keep that communication open. So that was a factor in Hue, you know, being able to call back to artillery to have them target areas. But in many ways, it is this hand-to-hand combat. It can get to that level, yes.
Was this population of Hue here sympathetic to the North Vietnamese who had conquered their city at that time?
For the most part, no. They're trying to survive.
Yeah.
So one of the things that the North Vietnamese would do during the Tet Offensive, if they could identify that you were a government official, that you were an important business person, that you were someone who worked with the Americans in some capacity, you were likely to be executed.
Wow.
So, you know, anyone who had important positions is trying to run and hide. But the reality is you're going to get caught in the crossfire. Even though the U.S. and the South Vietnamese forces were trying to be careful because they're there to defend these people. But the reality of urban warfare is that even when you're careful, there are going to be civilian casualties.
Yeah. Any more examples of modern urban warfare that stand out?
Yeah, so I'll take us kind of more recent for our last one. So if we think of the 1990s, we get a boom in urban warfare
in the 1990s,
tied to civil wars, tied to interventions. The most famous one from an American perspective is probably Mogadishu in Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
The famous movie and book Black Hawk Down, where the urban confines make it incredibly difficult to get in the reinforcements once you have the helicopter go down, and then additional helicopters go down. So you have that tension between the helicopter is critical in that it's providing firepower to help keep people alive on the ground until reinforcements come, but it's also incredibly vulnerable. In the Balkans, you have the Yugoslav wars.
Yeah.
So Sarajevo is the capital of Bosnia-Herzegovina, and it is under siege by Republika Srpska forces from April of 1992 until February of 1996.
I'm sorry, you said April of 1992 to February of 1996?
Yes.
That's almost 4 years.
Yes.
How, in that time,
so let me tell you a bit about the geography of Sarajevo. So in that part of the Balkans, most of the cities are in valleys because you have mountains. And so Sarajevo is at the bottom of this valley. And the Republika Srpska, the ethnic Serb forces, have their positions up on the slopes of the mountain. So they are looking down, perfect line of sight into the city of Sarajevo. There is nowhere safe to hide.
That makes them so vulnerable.
And so the Serbian snipers and artillery have, they can do whatever they want. There are Bosniak defenders, but they can't break out. There are UN, the UN office that stays in Sarajevo. The airfield is outside of the siege line. And they dug tunnels from the city to the airfield. You can actually today go and do a tour of parts of the tunnel closest to the airfield. And that is one of the main ways that people got in and out who weren't tied to the UN mission, which could get through the lines. Although there are cases of that where they then came under fire themselves. Sniping was a problem. So anytime civilians went out of their home to go and get water, to go and get food, they're running the risk of being killed. Actually, one of the key moments that helped bring the war to an end and really got the U.S. more involved was Serbian artillery shelling of a open-air marketplace. So kind of like a farmer's market type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it killed a large number of civilians who were just there doing their grocery shopping. There's very graphic video if your listeners really want to go see it. But that really captured global attention and American attention, and the U.S. really started pushing after that for there to be some sort of negotiated end. Another thing to consider, we've mostly been framing this discussion from the idea that there is some value to the people in the city you're taking. When you add that to a conflict that has ethnic cleansing, that is not the case.
It's interesting that you say that because I literally wrote this, queued this up to saying, wait, did they intend to enter the city or just shoot at it forever.
Yeah. And so it depends. So another case, it's not, it didn't end up really involving much in the way of urban warfare, but is linked to this concept, Srebrenica. So it's another city in Bosnia, and it was set as a UN safe area. And there were a detachment of Dutch peacekeepers just outside the city at the UN base. And so it had not only its own population, but many Bosniaks kind of in the area had sought shelter there because it's supposed to be safe. Again, it's in a valley. The Republican Srpska forces are up in the mountains looking down, and they vastly outnumber the UN peacekeepers. Some of the civilians, as things are getting tenser, as the Serbs move in, seek shelter in the UN base, but are then forced to leave the UN base. All told, over 7,000 Bosniak men and boys were massacred at Srebrenica. So not what we often think of with urban warfare, but because of the lack of urban warfare, we have this ethnic cleansing instead. Similarly, if you think of Vukovar, the fighting in Vukovar, like the civilian lives don't necessarily have any value because they're the wrong ethnicity. And so if you're going to kill them anyway, then the attacking force isn't going to think about minimizing civilian casualties as part of the attack.
I just hadn't thought about that sort of formula in the whole calculus of urban warfare. It gives the attacking army, invading army, conquering army much more liberty in what they can do. There's no restraint. You with respect to Srebrenica, you said once the Serbians entered. So does that at some point become hand-to-hand combat or no, still?
So part of the deal with being the safe area is that it was demilitarized.
Oh, boy.
Because UN peacekeepers were there to provide the security.
Which, in effect, they didn't based on what you're telling me.
No. I mean, so they were vastly outnumbered. At the time, it was the procedures for getting any type of air support days. And just like the civilians were in the crosshairs of the Serbian artillery, so was the UN base. And so the decision was made at the time not to resist. The peacekeepers a couple years ago were actually found responsible for a portion of those killed. So about 300 of the Bosniaks who were subsequently killed had been accepted into the UN base and then were told to leave. And those were the ones that they were found to be liable for what happened to them after they left.
That's unfortunate. We'll be back after a short break to talk about rules and restraints in urban warfare. We'll be right back. Hey there, news peelers. We're working on a brand new website with many super duper features, including videos of our guests and compilations of our episodes into series, with related blogs that are updated weekly, like series on US politics, economy, health policies, environment, women's rights, and also series on many other countries, like Russia, Ukraine, China, and Brazil, and the British monarchy. And also a series on revolutions and protests, like those in Iran, Israel, and France. So be sure to check it out at historybehindnews.com. See you guys there. Dr. Walters, in the examples you shared with me about 20th century modern urban warfare. We talked about populations, for example, in Stalingrad. At some point, the population was just gone or depleted by death. Which makes me wonder, in urban warfare, are there military tactics to prevent civilian casualties? And by the way, to clarify, I'm not referring to sort of moral precepts here. My question is really going to, are there like codified strategies in military manuals?
Yes.
Yes, and okay.
It does actually link back, though, to the moral by way of the laws that govern warfare and international law. So in any war, in any type of warfare, so not just in urban warfare, the U.S. military has requirements to protect and aid civilians. It is illegal to deliberately target civilians. In war, you can't target places like hospitals, as long as it's being used as a hospital. With any of these, there are caveats, I guess is a way to put it, or conditions. So if a group is using a hospital facility to launch rockets, then that hospital may become an acceptable target.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
At that point, what would happen in the U.S. is that the lawyers on staff who are part of this decision-making process would go through the rules of engagement and determine whether the necessity of taking out that military capability would justify whatever the expected civilian casualties would be.
This all sounds so, I don't know, organized and step by step. I mean, when you're out there, if God forbid U.S. forces are once again in some sort of urban warfare situation and rockets are coming or snipers are shooting at them from a hospital, do they have time to call the lawyers back in Washington? Is that what really happens? I mean, these decisions are being made, I suppose, really quickly.
So we're kind of, it's two things, right? So are you talking about like infantry forces, ground troops who are having to make that split decision, or is it the process that goes into selecting targets for airstrikes? So
I guess any target
for an airstrike has to be cleared through this process. So one thing you might consider in this type of environment is, are there alternative methods for removing the military target that would have fewer casualties? So could you, instead of doing an airstrike, could you do something more precise with a drone? Could you use, insert a special operations team to remove it? So you'd go through, see, okay, how can I minimize the civilian casualties? Is the military target of sufficient importance to justify the expected civilian losses? But the key is you can't intentionally target civilians for the sake of targeting civilians. And so there are ways of trying to avoid that. So I'll give you an example. So in 2016, 2017, I have the dates here somewhere, October 2016 to January 2017, as Iraqi forces are trying to retake Mosul from ISIS.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
U.S. was providing air support. But there were actually tensions between Iraqi forces and U.S. forces because the U.S. wanted 2 points of verification for targets. So they weren't willing to just take what the command, the Iraqi commander on the ground was saying. As, you know, this is a target, it's a military target, there aren't civilians. They wanted, the U.S. wanted to have like their own eyes on target. And so would delay strikes in order to either get a plane in place that could see the target or to get a drone in place to be able to look at the target before approving a strike, which caused delays and sometimes missed opportunities to take out genuine, you know, ISIS targets that you want to get rid of. But that was an example of that compromise in military effectiveness in order to try and minimize civilian casualties. Now, that being said, the fighting in Mosul is estimated to probably have killed, I think it's about 15,000 civilians. So it's not completely successful. And part of it is like, does your opponent care? Right, so ISIS is not going to be super concerned with civilian casualties. So they are not going to mind using civilians as shields or co-opting places that should be safe and making them military targets. So in a similar way to what Hamas does, right? So intentionally using schools or hospitals as places to launch rockets from, intentionally putting civilians between them and the IDF in ways that, you know, put civilians in danger.
You know, we're talking about civilians and whether or not your opponent cares about civilians, whether it's their own people or such as the example of Vietnam, where they captured the city, although they were both Vietnamese, but still. As you were sharing this with me, I thought of hostages. Like, how does this complicate all of this? Now you have hostages. They're just not civilians. Now it's part of strategy to use them in some capacity. How does that fit in all of this?
Yeah. So in some ways, it's not a new problem in that you've had groups in the past who have not allowed civilians to escape out of cities. I mean, the ideal thing that happens when you know you're going to go into an urban environment is to encourage the civilians to leave before the fighting starts, as long as there's somewhere for them to go.
Yeah.
So in some of the fighting in Iraq, so Mosul, for example, many of the civilians were able to flee to other Iraqi cities. Mm-hmm. But ISIS actually didn't let all of them leave. So then, like, they're stuck. And they don't want to be there. They're not a party to it, but they're not allowed to leave. Having formal hostages, like what Hamas has in Israel right now, is a bit different. But obviously, it causes massive problems. Ideally, you know, like with any hostage situation, the best way to get people out is through negotiation. The moment you start using force, the likelihood of everyone getting out alive goes down dramatically. Yeah,
that's unfortunate.
Either because they're going to get caught in the crossfire or the kidnappers are going to intentionally kill them out of revenge or spite or whatever it is. So it massively complicates any planning. And we can kind of see this in the delay that the IDF has had with their what had been anticipated to have started several days ago now, their ground invasion into Gaza.
Yeah.
But it seems that they've keep pushing it back. And I would imagine they're trying to pinpoint where some of these hostages are being held.
Yeah, I bet. You know, I've in my prior communications with you, I pointed this out, and then since then I've researched it, and it's about rules, conventions of wars against the siege of an urban area. And so when I first sort of volleyed that question to you in preparation for our conversation, I'm like, okay, so there are conventions, and I thought nothing of it really. But as it got closer, it sort of perplexed me. Well, If you are, and I'm not saying it's a good or bad thing, I'm just thinking about this. If you are an invading army to a military to an urban area, if you don't surround it, if you don't lay siege, then that defending force could just constantly get military help from someone. Again, this is, I'm not talking about Gaza or Israel. I'm just talking historically. Mm-hmm. From a military perspective, it makes sense to lay siege to an area that you want to subdue, right?
Yep.
So are the rules against it specifically for siege of humanitarian aspects, or are they more general?
So, gonna do the wording. I'm not a lawyer. I know enough to be dangerous.
Okay.
Sieges are legal under international law.
They are legal. Okay.
It is. Okay. With caveats. Okay. Sieges that are purely, again, to harm civilians or not. So if your purpose of the siege is just to punish a civilian population, that's illegal.
Okay.
If it is that you are trying to take out your opponent, then yes, absolutely militarily, it makes sense to cut off their supply routes to make sure they're not getting reinforcements, additional ammo, etc. That being said, under kind of international law, if for at least countries that are signatories, you are not supposed to starve out the civilian population, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, that's not cool. At the same time, you want to deny resources to your opponent. And so it's not a blanket kind of law in that you have to allow everything. And you can cut off kind of supply, but you're not supposed to have that undue human suffering. And this is where there's a lot of gray areas in terms of what is acceptable and what is not.
It can become very complex. Again, let's just put Israel and Gaza aside, just any party, because you have to really monitor what's coming in. And in addition, some of the civilians may be both civilian and also a member of the fighting force. And it's really hard to...
How do you tell?
How do you tell? While you want to starve the fighting force, you don't want to starve the civilians. Historically speaking, I'm just wondering, have there been any instances where a dominant party has refrained from bombarding a city or anything like that because of the civilians inside?
There are cases where the dominant party has shown restraint. Mm-hmm. So in the Italian campaigns and World War II, U.S. bombing was very careful to try and avoid the historic richness of Rome.
Yeah.
And to not bomb, you know, the Vatican or some, you know, the famous churches and sites and things. There are cases where the military objective made it undesirable to bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of Operation Market Garden in the Second World War, this is a plan with three airborne divisions dropped in Eindhoven, Nijmegen, Arnhem. And the plan is then for the kind of tank corps to drive up this one road.
So this is Southwest Germany?
Holland.
Holland. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
They are heading towards Germany. Yes.
Okay.
And the aim is to have this fast movement up and being able to hit kind of an undefended part of the line.
Okay.
And have a major breakthrough. The key to this is all of the bridges need to be taken intact. And so with the lack of precision in bombing at the time, you don't want to bomb the cities in case you accidentally blow up the bridge. That would be bad.
Yeah.
And so there's not a lot of bombardment that happens as part of the fighting to take these cities. So it's more small arms fire and machine guns fire. But generally, if you have the ability to take out your opponent's targets in the city, you're going to use it.
Yeah.
If you're the U.S. or another kind of high-tech country that cares about civilian casualties, you're going to do everything you can to do it in a way that minimizes civilian casualties and impacts on civilians. But, yeah.
Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Walters as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Walters, what lessons can we glean from the history of urban warfare for the potential urban war in Gaza now?
I think it's important to keep in mind that no matter how careful you are, no matter how careful the IDF is, there are going to be lots of images, and I'm sure Hamas will capitalize on them, coming out of civilian casualties. We may see more than in previous conflicts. Historically, the IDF has been very careful with civilian casualties, using, for example, a type of bombing where they'll drop a small munition on a roof to warn the residents to get out.
Oh, is that what they call knocking? Knocking, yeah.
Yep. So then they'll do the bigger one. Given what's happened, there's a lot of rhetoric that's come from IDF officials that makes it sound like they may not be quite as careful. I mean, so that, like, roof tapping isn't something they have to do and still be within the law of war. So I'm not trying to say they're going to break the law of war in what they do, but we may see a less restrained approach than in previous times when they've gone into Gaza or the West Bank. Another thing I think we should keep in mind from the past is that Hamas's actions are likely to make it worse.
In what sense? What specifically?
So the more that they use civilians as shields, the more difficult it's going to be for the IDF to conduct any type of operation and keep those civilian casualties number low. Is especially with urban warfare, it takes two sides to care about civilians for civilians to be safe. Mm-hmm. The geography of Gaza is also going to play into it. You've already got rubble. You know, we talked about the rubble in the context of Stalingrad. That's going to make the fighting more difficult once you have forces coming in. It's going to make it harder for Israeli tanks to move. It's going to make them more vulnerable to ambushes. You know, in the classic ambush, you know, it doesn't even have to be in an urban environment. We saw this with the famous, like, tank column heading towards Kyiv and the opening days of the Russian attack.
If you
hit the lead tank and the tail tank, the rest of the tanks are stuck.
Wow.
You know, so just like you can do that on that open road, you can do that, you know, even more with more effect in narrow streets. Many of the buildings in Gaza are not built to like Western building code. So they're already not structurally super. Even if they're not hit by an artillery shell or a bomb, all of that going off in the area around them is going to make them less structurally sound. So that could cause problems going forward with these unstable buildings. Another piece is that there is nowhere for the civilians to go.
Yeah, so, unlike Mosul example, where he says some of them fled this before ISIS stopped them from going. Okay.
Exactly, right? So yes, they've been encouraged to move to the southern part of Gaza, but the conditions there are so bad, even with the recent convoys of aid that has been allowed in, that many civilians are going back north because there is nowhere for them to be in South Gaza.
Wow.
It is just so crowded and the conditions are so bad. So it is not a question of if there are going to be civilians, there will be civilians there.
That's unfortunate. If you wanted our audience to remember just one point about urban warfare after everything we talked about in the last hour, what would it be?
I think it's that there's no good way to do it.
Oh, wow.
Urban warfare is absolutely horrific. It is incredibly taxing on the individual fighters. There's interesting research coming out of, you know, the American kind of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that seems to be indicating that because you're having to make the decisions about is this person a combatant or not, you know, particularly if you're dealing with a type of urban warfare where your opponent isn't in uniform necessarily, that it has a much more kind of taxing on mental health. It is always going to be bad for civilians. You know, no matter how careful either side is, it is never going to be a good outcome for the civilians involved. And it's tragic when it happens. You know, sometimes it's necessary. War can be necessary, but anytime you have urban warfare, it's tragic.
Yeah. Dr. Walters, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past. Rather, is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to Adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.